David came out into the impersonal concrete and glass arrivals hall of Schiphol Airport, and he paused to gloat on his escape and to revel at the sense of anonymity in the uncaring crowd. There was a touch at his elbow, and he turned to find a tall, smiling Dutchman quizzing him through rimless spectacles. Mr. David Morgan, I think? And David gaped at him. I'm Frederick van Ghent of Holland and Indonesian stevedoring. We have the honor to act on behalf of Morgan Shipping Lines in Holland. It is a great pleasure to make your acquaintance. Oh, God, no, David whispered wearily. Please? No, I'm sorry. It's nice to meet you. David shook the hand with resignation. I have two urgent telex messages for you, Mr. Morgan. Van Ghent produced them with a flourish. I have driven out from Amsterdam specially to deliver them. The first was from Mitzi, who had sworn to cover for him. Abject apologies, your whereabouts extracted with rack and thumbscrew, stop. Be brave as a lion, stop. Be ferocious as an eagle. Love, Mitzi. David said, traitorous bitch, and opened the second envelope. Your doubts understood, your action condoned, stop. Confident your good sense will lead you eventually on to path of duty, stop. Your place here always open, affectionately, Paul Morgan. David said, crafty old bastard, and stuffed both messages into his pocket. Is there a reply? Van Ghent asked. Thank you, no. It was good of you to take this trouble. No trouble, Mr. Morgan. Can I help you in any way? Is there anything you require? Nothing, but thanks again. They shook hands, and Van Ghent bowed and left him. David went to the Avis counter, and the girl smiled brightly at him. Good evening, sir. David slipped his Avis card across the desk. I want something with a little jump to it, please. Let me see. We have a Mustang Mach 1. She was pure blonde with a cream and pink unlined face. That'll do admirably, David assured her. And as she began filling the form in, she asked, Your first visit to Amsterdam, sir? They tell me it's the city with the most action in Europe, is that right? If you know where to go, she murmured. You could show me? David asked, and she looked up at him with calculating eyes behind a neutral expression, made a decision, and resumed her writings. Please sign here, sir. Your account will be charged. Then she dropped her voice. If you have any queries on this contract, you can contact me at this number, after hours. My name is Gilda. Gilda shared a walk-up over the outer canal with three other girls who showed no surprise and made no objection when David carried his single Samsonite case up the steep staircase. However, the action that Gilda provided was in a series of discotheques and coffee bars where lost little people gathered to talk revolution and guru babble. In 2 days, David discovered that pot tasted terrible and made him nauseous, and that Gilda's mind was as bland and unmarked as her exterior. He felt the stirrings of uneasiness when he studied the others that had been drawn to this city by the news that it was wide open with the most understanding police force in the world. In them he saw symptoms of his own restlessness, and he recognized them as fellow seekers. Then the damp chill of the lowlands seemed to rise up out of the canals like the spirits of the dead on doomsday. And when you've been born under the sun of Africa, the wintry effusions of the north are a pale substitute. Gilda showed no visible emotion when she said goodbye, and with the heaters blasting hot air into the cab of the Mustang, David sent it booming southwards. On the outskirts of Namur, there was a girl standing beside the road. In the cold, her legs were bare and brown, protruding sweetly from the short, faded blue denim pants she wore. She tilted her golden head and cocked a thumb. David hit the stick down and braked with the rubber squealing protest. He reversed back to where she stood. She had flat-planed Slavic features, and her hair was white-blonde and hung in a thick plait down her back. He guessed her age at 19. "You speak English?" he asked through the window. The cold was making her nipples stand out like marbles through the thin fabric of her shirt. "No," she said, "but I speak American. Will that do?" "Right on," David opened the passenger door, and she threw her pack and rolled sleeping bag into the back seat. I'm Philly, she said. David, you in showbiz? God know what makes you ask. The car, the face, the clothes. The car is hired, the clothes are stolen, and I'm wearing a mask. Funny man, she said, and curled up on the seat like a kitten and went to sleep. He stopped in a village where the forests of the Ardennes begin and bought a long roll of crisp bread, a slab of smoked wild boar meat, and a bottle of Moët Chandon. When he got back to the car, Philly was awake. You hungry? He asked. Sure, she stretched and yawned. He found a logger's track going off into the forest, and they followed it to a clearing where a long golden shaft of sunlight penetrated the green cathedral gloom. Philly climbed out and looked around her. Keen, Davy, keen, she said. David poured the champagne into paper cups and sliced the meat with a penknife, while Philly broke the bread into hunks. They sat side by side on a fallen log and ate. It's so quiet and peaceful, not at all like a killing ground. This is where the Germans made their last big effort, did you know that? Philly's mouth was full of bread and meat, which didn't stop her reply. I saw the movie. Henry Fonda, Robert Ryan. It was a complete crock. All that death and ugliness. We should do something beautiful in this place, David said dreamily. And she swallowed the bread, took a sip of the wine, before she stood up languidly and went to the Mustang. She fetched her sleeping bag and spread it on the soft bed of leaf mold. Some things are for talking about, others for doing, she told him. For a while in Paris, it looked as though it might be significant, as though they might have something for each other of importance. They found a room with a shower in a clean and pleasant little pension near the Gare Saint-Lazare, and they walked through the streets all that day from Concorde to Étoile, then across to the Eiffel Tower and back to Notre Dame. They ate supper at a sidewalk cafe on the Boule Miche, but halfway through the meal they reached an emotional dead end. Suddenly they ran out of conversation. They sensed it at the same time, each aware that they were strangers in all but the flesh, and the knowledge chilled them both. Still, they stayed together that night, even going through the mechanical and empty motions of love. But in the morning, when David came out of the shower, she sat up in the bed and said, "You're splitting." It was a statement, and not a question, and it needed no reply. "Are you all right for bread?" he asked, and she shook her head. He peeled off a pair of 1,000-franc notes and put them on the side table. "I'll pay the bill downstairs." He picked up his bag. "Stay loose," he said. Paris was spoiled for him now, so he took the road south again towards the sun, for the sky was filled with swollen black cloud, and it rained before he passed the turnoff to Fontainebleau. It rained as he believed was only possible in the tropics, a solid deluge that flooded the concrete of the highway and blurred his windscreen so that the flogging of the wipers could not clear it swiftly enough for safe vision. David was alone and discomforted by his inability to sustain communication with another human being. Although the other traffic had moderated its pace in the rain, he drove fast, feeling the drift and skate of his tires on the slick surface. This time, the calming effect of speed was ineffective, and when he ran out of the rain, south of Beaune, it seemed that the wolf pack of loneliness ran close behind him. However, the first outpouring of sunshine lightened his mood. And then, far over the stone walls and rigid green lines of the vineyards, he saw a windsock floating like a soft white sausage from its pole. He found the exit from the highway half a mile further on, and the sign Club Aéronautique de Provence. He followed it to a neat little airfield set among the vineyards, and one of the aircraft on the hard stand was a Marchetti Aerobatic Type F260. David climbed out of the Mustang and stared at it like a drunkard contemplating his first whiskey of the day. The Frenchman in the club office looked like an unsuccessful undertaker, and even when David showed him his logbook and sheafs of licenses, he resisted the temptation of hiring him the Marchetti. David could take his pick from the others, but the Marchetti was not for hire. David added a 500-franc note to the pile of documents, and it disappeared miraculously into the Frenchman's pocket. Still, he would not let David take the Marchetti solo, and he insisted on joining him in the instructor's seat. David executed a slow and stately four-point roll before they had crossed the boundary fence. It was an act of defiance, and he made the stops crisp and exaggerated. The Frenchman cried, "Sacré bleu!" with great feeling and froze in his seat, but he had the good sense not to interfere with the controls. David completed the maneuver and then immediately rolled in the opposite direction with the wingtip a mere 50 feet above the tips of the vines. The Frenchman relaxed visibly, recognizing the masterly touch, and when David landed an hour later, he grinned mournfully at him. "Formidable," he said, and shared his lunch with David. Garlic polony, bread, and a bottle of rank red wine. The good feeling of flight and the aroma of garlic lasted David all the way to Madrid. In Madrid, suddenly, it began to happen, almost as though it had been arranged long before, as though his frantic flight across half of Europe was a pre-knowledge that something of importance awaited him in Madrid. He reached the city in the evening, hurrying the last day's journey to be in time for the first running of the bulls that season. He had read Hemingway and Conrad and much of the other romantic literature of the bullring. He wondered if there might not be something for him in this way of life. It read so well in the books, the beauty, glamour, and excitement, the courage and trial, and the final moment of truth. He wanted to evaluate it, to see it here in the great Plaza de Toros. And then, if it still intrigued him, go on to the festival at Pamplona later in the season. David checked in at the Gran Via, with its elegance faded to mere comfort, and the porter arranged tickets for the following day. He was tired from the long drive, and he went to bed early, waking refreshed and eager for the day. He found his way out to the ring and parked the Mustang amongst the tourist buses that already crowded the parking lot so early in the season. The exterior of the ring was a surprise, sinister as the temple of some pagan and barbaric religion, unrelieved by the fluted tiers of balconies and encrustations of ceramic tiles. But the interior was as he knew it would be from film and photograph. The sanded rings smooth and clean, the flags against the cloud-flecked sky, the orchestra pouring out its jerky, rousing refrain, and the excitement. The excitement amongst the crowd was more intense than he had known at prize fights or football internationals. They hummed and swarmed, rank upon rank of white, eager faces, and the music goaded them on. David was sitting amongst a group of young Australians who wore souvenir sombreros and passed goat skins of bad wine about, the girls squealing and chittering like sparrows. One of them picked on David, leaning forward to tug his shoulder and offer him the wineskin. She was pretty enough in a kittenish way, and her eyes made it clear that the offer was for more than cheap wine. But he refused both invitations brusquely and went to fetch a can of beer from one of the vendors. His chilly experience with the girl in Paris was still too fresh. When he returned to his seat, the Aussie girl eyed the beer he carried reproachfully and then turned brightly and smiling to her companions. The late arrivals were finding their seats now, and the excitement was escalating sharply. Two of them climbed the stairs of the aisle towards where David sat. A striking young couple in their early 20s. But what first drew David's attention was the good feeling of companionship and love that glowed around them, like an aura setting them apart. They climbed arm in arm, past where David sat, and took seats a row behind and across the aisle. The girl was tall, with long legs, clad in short black boots and dark pants, over which she wore an apple-green suede jacket that was not expensive but of good cut and taste. In the sun, her hair glittered like coal newly cut from the face, and it hung to her shoulders in a sleek, soft fall. Her face was broad and sun-browned, not beautiful, for her mouth was too big and her eyes too widely spaced, but those eyes were the colour of wild honey, dark brown and flecked with gold. Like her, her companion was tall and straight, dark and strong-looking. He guided her to her seat with a brown, muscled arm, and David felt a sharp stab of anger and envy for him. "Big, cocky son of a gun," he thought. They leaned their heads together and spoke secretly, and David looked away, his own loneliness accentuated by their closeness.